This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. According to court documents, confidential sources played a key role in uncovering the plot to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer. But how do federal and state prosecutors build a case that proves the accused were actually going to do the things they said they planned to do? Greg Stayskull knows that without confidential sources, investigating extremist groups would be difficult. Stayskull worked for the FBI for 31 years. He now does consulting for legal matters, and he joins us. Greg Stayskull, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you. Happy to be here.
We know that the accused were referred to federal investigators by a local police department. Can you give us some context for how often that happens and if we should infer any level of intent from the fact that someone at a local police department reached out?
Well, I'm not sure you can infer anything beyond that it is a regular occurrence that cases are discussed, referred, or whatever to the FBI from local departments. It happens on a very regular basis. Sometimes we develop the cases on our own, and sometimes we go to the local departments with cases that we have because there's not only federal issues involved, there's state crimes involved as well, which obviously in this case applies to some extent.
It appears that fairly early on in the federal investigation that confidential human sources, or what the public generally refers to as informants, came into play in the case. Can you explain a little bit about why investigators use confidential informants?
Yeah, and that's a bit of a misnomer, at least in terms of the way the Bureau terminology works. A confidential informant, or CI, is somebody that remains confidential. And generally speaking, if you characterize somebody as a confidential informant, they will not ordinarily be a witness, and you will not give up their confidentiality. In this case, what we would term these people as are cooperating witnesses, because it was obvious from the beginning, at some point, these people, the people that are being termed as informants, would have to testify. For one thing, anytime you record conversations, the person recording those conversations ultimately is going to have to testify. You would never have a confidential informant, somebody that you wanted to remain confidential, record a conversation, because by the very act of recording a conversation, you are putting that person in a position where they're going to have to testify at some point to that recording.
We know from the criminal complaint that the sources the FBI was working with in this case do not have a criminal record. Is there anything you can tell us about the kind of people that federal investigators might ask to assist? The fact that they're cooperating witnesses implies that they at one point were involved.
That may be the case. In this case, obviously, these people were involved, but they may have been involved at our urging to continue to be in a position where they could report progress to us. But it's interesting, there's an adage that we use in prosecuting cases involving cooperating witnesses that conspiracies hatched in hell cannot have angels for witnesses. So oftentimes our witnesses are not the greatest people in the world. And I'm not making any comment about who these people are that are involved in this particular case, because I don't even know who they are. But oftentimes they do have criminal records and they are involved in the conspiracy at some level. And again, oftentimes the people that you need to have cooperate and to testify are not going to be angels.
Are cooperating witnesses typically paid for their work?
Cooperating witnesses can be paid, and that always has to be approved by the prosecuting attorney, at least in the federal system. For the very reason is you don't want the payments to then be used to attack their credibility. In other words, it should not be looked upon as a bounty, but oftentimes it may be used to cover expenses and things like that, because these people are giving, you know, depending on how the situation works out, these cooperating witnesses may be taking time off from work, or they have to travel someplace and things like that. So you do, in fact, pay them. But it's usually in terms of compensation, not to be looked upon as a reward.
Well, that kind of leads me to my next question. When cases like this have played out in court, it's common for defense attorneys to try to show that a cooperating witness had some motivation for doing what they were doing or some motivation to move a plan or a plot along themselves. Are there ways that investigators can design their work to show some transparency or to prevent claims like that from sticking?
Yes, and one of the ways you do that is by recording conversations. You try not to do that selectively, sometimes because of the circumstances, it is selective, but you try not to do it selectively, and you talk to the informant or the, in this case, a cooperating witness. You explain to them that you cannot be the driving force here. You go along, you report it. You may have to say some things to the person that you're uncomfortable with, but that's the way that this has to work. And based on what I've seen so far in the evidence, it appears that that worked well in this case. But sometimes you have to be careful because, you know, witnesses may say things that are problematic. There have been situations, for example, like, and this is a hypothetical, you have people planning to rob a bank. And the guy that you ultimately charge is saying, you know, I'm only robbing this bank because, you know, my kids are starving and I really don't want to do it. And the guys tell him, hey, don't worry about it. We'll push it forward and we'll do this. And those are the kind of things where you're looking at as possible entrapment.
There have been a couple of domestic terrorism investigations in which plots were shaped in one way or another by cooperating witnesses or informants. But it was the accused person who pushed a button or enacted what they thought might move a plot forward. And the thinking has been that it's important to identify people who have the capacity to do something like that before they get involved with someone who could help them put an actual plan into practice. Can you explain what the thinking has been about that in recent years?
Sure. In criminal law, the defense of entrapment, it's a tricky defense because, in effect, you are admitting what has happened, but you're saying that you were induced into committing the criminal act or at least participating in the conspiracy to commit the criminal act. What the law looks at, and it's sort of an overarching rule, is if the idea is hatched in the defendant's mind, he has the criminal intent initially. Merely giving him the opportunity, he or she, or giving them the means to carry out the crime is not entrapment. It is in order to further the conspiracy that was going forward on its own, but it gives you the opportunity, let me put it this way, to control the conspiracy.
Do you think that that's been an effective method?
Well, I think in this case, it appears to have been very effective. And it's not a bad thing, for example, in this case, for the defendants, for them to be in a position where they are relying on the cooperating witness and ultimately an undercover agent to provide them, in this case, with explosives. Apparently, the people in this conspiracy allegedly were experimenting with improvised explosive devices, but they couldn't come up with anything of the size they needed. They wanted to blow up a bridge. So the cooperating witness provides them with an opportunity to get explosives from a person who turned out to be an undercover agent.
This was someone the alleged conspirators believed was going to sell them what they needed to blow up the bridge, but he was actually an FBI employee.
Correct. And what this does is gives us the ability to control this. We don't want them out there experimenting with bombs and or building their own bomb. We want to be able to tell them that we can supply them with a bomb. And if in fact we do supply them with a bomb, that bomb is incapable of working, which has been done in the past. In this case, it wasn't, but we didn't have them out there looking for something else. And when I read that, the first thing I thought about was Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh experimenting with IEDs on the Nichols farm up in Decker, Michigan. and they were out there experimenting. And they obviously, at least Timothy McVeigh, mastered the ability to build very explosive ammonium nitrate bombs, which he used in Oklahoma City. So it would have been nice if we could have been in control of that conspiracy.
If you're just joining us today, my guest is Greg Stayskull. He is a retired agent of the FBI with 31 years experience. Defense attorneys have already laid out the idea in the initial bond hearings that their clients, these men were amateurs and really not capable of pulling off these plans. Would a jury have to believe that the accused men were capable of doing this in order to find them guilty of hatching a plot?
No, that's not an element of the crime. It's a conspiracy to commit a criminal act. And again, I would point to Timothy McVeigh was not an expert. He developed an expertise. The point is that these people had the capability. It wasn't a well-thought-out plan, but they had the capability of carrying it out. And even if it hadn't been successful, it had the potential for causing significant harm, up to and including somebody getting killed.
If that's the case, what might the defense's motivation be in making those arguments at this point?
It's not an argument that I think would play necessarily well with a judge or a magistrate, but it might be something that the jury might buy into. But the point is that they are being charged with a conspiracy to commit a criminal act, in this case, kidnapping and or murder. And their ability to successfully carry off the conspiracy is not an element of the offense. But it has to be, I think, rise to the level that it's a conspiracy that they intended to carry out and that they were doing acts to carry out. And that, at least allegedly, occurred.
So let's say a cooperating witness is taking part in a case like this. Is there an obligation on the part of the person who's working with the FBI to maybe give information that might show a person is less guilty or maybe less than competent? In other words, is there any obligation on the part of a confidential source to say something that might help the defense?
Well, a cooperating witness is going to testify. He's going to testify on direct examination, and then he's going to have to submit to being questioned by the defense. And the defense, those are questions that the defense will ask. Did you believe that these people could do what they say? Do you believe that they really intended to do? And that witness has sworn to tell the truth. He's under oath, and he or she will have to testify whether or not they believed that these people had the intent to carry out the conspiracy.
And as you've told us, conversations were recorded at many stages of the game. So that would be information that the jury might ultimately hear, assuming this all goes to trial, right?
Sure. And anything in any of those conversations that would indicate that there was a lack of criminal intent on part of whoever they're defending, any of those type of things, the defense would want to bring those out. And under discovery, prior to the trial, if there is a trial, the defense would have access to all of the recorded conversations because they're all evidence. Now, the government is obviously not necessarily going to play all of the conversations. They're going to play the ones they believe make their case, so to speak. They might play them all, but they're not obligated to do that. But the defense will have access to all of them, and they would be able to introduce conversations that maybe the prosecution doesn't.
At least one of the attorneys for one of the defendants, we should say that they have separate counsel, has at least been hinting that one of the accused men tried to tell the informant that they needed to stop one of the accused ringleaders going through with the plan. The FBI agent who was named in the complaint, who was involved in the hearings, didn't know about it. Do you think that might be an important piece of testimony?
Well, it would be certainly for that. But if the individual that said that to the cooperating witness is indicating he had a change of heart, then certainly that would be something that could conceivably at least mitigate his guilt. And that would be something that the jury, or assuming there's a trial, that the jury should hear or that a judge should hear. But that's the obligation of the defense to bring that up. I'm not aware, you know, of the specific conversation, but if that's the case, that's the way it would be used. Now, having said that, that person who made that comment, that wouldn't necessarily mean that he or she wouldn't be, I guess they're all he's in this case, that they wouldn't be charged, but they may be charged with a lesser offense. And I wouldn't be surprised in this case. We have the cooperating witnesses that worked from the beginning or near the beginning of this conspiracy with the government. But I wouldn't be surprised if other individuals that have been charged in this case may ultimately end up testifying on behalf of the government.
Greg, you were with the FBI long enough to have been around for the investigation into the Oklahoma City bombings, Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. Can you tell us a little bit about what you think investigators learned about domestic terrorism plots during that period and maybe how that might form what's going on today?
Well, I think the motivation, and certainly the motivation in the Oklahoma City bombing, was to some extent different from the motivation, this alleged case that we're talking about now with the Michigan militia. But there are some commonalities to all of this. I mean, Timothy McVeigh technically was not a member of a militia, although some of his philosophy is similar to it. Timothy McVeigh was present for a portion of the Waco standoff with David Koresh and the people outside of Waco, Texas, in their compound. He was extremely upset with the way that was handled by the government. He already had anti-government feelings. He had been in the Army and then was out of the Army. He was also a white supremacist, but the Waco thing set him off as being anti-government. He probably was that way already, but it just exacerbated his feelings. And then he moved forward. His conspiracy was very small in the number of people, and they didn't involve a lot of people. And that was one of the reasons that it wasn't detected before the actual bombing. But obviously, even though Timothy McVeigh was probably not the most capable individual, he was capable enough to make a very large and devastating bomb and explode it next to the Oklahoma City Federal Building. And obviously his target, and that wasn't his first choice, but his target was to blow up a federal facility. So to that extent, this anti-government feeling sort of pervades the, to some extent, militia movement.
Were there things that you think were learned that maybe moved federal investigators toward more use of infiltration, toward more use of either cooperating witnesses or informants?
Yes, that's always the case. Your best means is to infiltrate. We did that extensively back in the 60s and 70s to infiltrate the Klan, and it was very effective. And if we had had the opportunity to infiltrate the McVeigh Terry Nichols conspiracy, we would have. But these individuals in the case we're presently talking about were using communication systems that were encrypted, which makes it, without having infiltration, makes it very difficult for us to understand what's going on. But we do know that this is a, when I say infiltration, a very effective tool, and ones we, you know, would try to use anytime we could in this situation.
Investigators' techniques using informants got a workout in the era where radical Islam was seen as a primary threat to domestic security. These days, it looks like the thinking is shifting. FBI Director Christopher Wray has put anti-government and white supremacist groups at the top of the threat list right now. Do you think that the techniques, that the use of informants as we've seen them in recent years is going to be effective for the kind of investigations the FBI is going to be taking on, if it means more cases like this?
Yes, and I think it has to be, and we have to work for it to be effective. And it's not always easy to do, but we have to make an effort to do it. And again, you know, in the past, in situations, you know, similar to the militia, and I'm not talking about all of the militia, but those that have intent to do harm, to commit criminal acts, we have to make an effort to monitor those organizations and to develop intelligence from within.
Do you think that the public should have any trepidation about the fact that sometimes it's people we don't know who make these prosecutions possible?
Well, no, I don't think, because I think they understand. And again, it comes down to a situation where, for us being the Bureau or law enforcement, to gain the intelligence we need to gain, oftentimes we have to utilize these type of methods. That's just the nature of the game. Again, it goes back to that adage, you know, conspiracies hatched in hell can't necessarily have angels for witnesses. And sometimes, you know, the witnesses and or the confidential sources aren't the greatest people in the world, but they are of value in getting intelligence on criminal conspiracies. And that's the only way we can operate.
Well, Greg Stayskull, we want to thank you very much for talking with us about this. Thanks for your time today.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm happy to do it.